Good morning. Thank you for your patience. I'm Charles Berry, Chairman of the Board of the New York Society Library. I'm pleased to welcome you here today on the happy occasion of the gift to our library of a book borrowed by the first President of the United States, but never returned. Our library is the oldest in New York City. We were founded in 1754, just before the French and Indian War, when the city was mostly located south of Wall Street and had a population of only 15,000 people. George Washington was 22. We received our charter from another George, George II of England. Our founders were a group called the New York Society, leading citizens dedicated to promoting culture and learning in a town that needed both. In the same year, they established King's College, now Columbia University, for which we served as the college library for our first 20 years or so. For more than 250 years, we have been a repository of literature, history, and popular reading, and a unique resource for many of our country's greatest writers. Washington Irving and Clement Clark Moore were trustees. Ralph Waldo Emerson lectured here. Herman Melville took out books on whaling when he was writing Moby Dick. And our members have included Willa Cather, W.H. Auden, John Cheever, David Halberstam, Wendy Wasserstein, Tom Wolfe, and many, many more. But today we are here to celebrate an association from our earliest days. In 1789, New York was the seat of the federal government, and on April 30 of that year, George Washington was inaugurated as the first President of the United States in what had been City Hall and was renamed Federal Hall. The library was located in a room on the second floor of that building at the intersection of Wall, Broad, and Nassau Streets, and it served essentially as the Library of Congress for the few years that the federal government sat in New York, before moving to Philadelphia and then to Washington, D.C. Many of the founding fathers used the library, which had reopened its doors just the year before. We were closed from 1774 to 1788 during the Revolutionary War and the occupation by the British, which included the burning of much of New York on September 21, 1776. Our fledgling collection is said to have been looted by British soldiers who bartered our books for grog. But in 1789, things were looking up, and the leaders of the nation were among our regular patrons. One of those was President Washington himself. According to the scrupulous records maintained by our librarian George Wright, on October 5, 1789, our foremost founding father is recorded as having taken out from the library a serious tome, Aimer de Vattel's Law of Nations, not bedtime reading, but the kind of work that the greatest architect of our great nation might be expected to digest. In fact, this book was an important one, particularly popular and influential in the early days of the Republic. A treatise on international law and relations, it became a classic text in the universities, and for over 100 years was cited as legal authority in scores of decisions by the United States Supreme Court and other courts of law. First published in 1758 by a Swiss diplomat, lawyer, and philosopher, the Law of Nations set forth a theory of the rights of nations based on principles of the rights of individuals that historians view is central to both the American Revolution and the French Revolution. We don't know exactly why George Washington wanted to read this popular book. Maybe he was prompted by the events in France, which had helped us win the war against England and was entering into its own revolution that very year with the storming of the Bastille on July 14, 1789. Or maybe he was thinking about the cohesiveness of his own country. His journal for that day of October 5, 1789 shows that he spoke with Treasury Secretary and library user Alexander Hamilton about making a tour of the eastern states to gauge the support for the new government. But we do know one sad fact. President Washington never returned the book to the library. We recently undertook a project to restore and digitize our original charging ledger for 1789, which shows every book borrowed and the name of the borrower and the date the book was taken out and returned. Vattel's Law of Nations was due to be returned on November 2, 1789, but the ledger shows that it never was. A recent inventory of our rare books confirmed that the volume is still missing. and there is no record of its having been borrowed after the first president took it out. The fines for overdue books in those days was 3 pence a day. Some have speculated that the accumulated fines for 220 years would amount to many thousands of dollars. The library was not about to pursue such a fine, but we were delighted to learn recently that a copy of this long-missing volume would be coming back to us. When the news broke a few weeks ago about George Washington's library fine, word reached Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens. Their president, James Reese, and librarian Joan Stahl contacted us and told us that they had located a copy of the same edition that had been borrowed by President Washington and wanted to give it to us. We are very pleased to have this important part of our history back with us, and I am particularly pleased to welcome Jim Reese and Joan Stahl, who are in the process of launching an important library of their own at Mount Vernon. I'd like to ask Jim Reese now to make a few remarks. As the president and executive director of Mount Vernon, Jim has done a fantastic job not only in maintaining the home of our first president, one of the most visited sites in the country, but also, and importantly, establishing an educational center and now an important library to keep alive the legacy of Washington's leadership and exemplary character. Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Charles. And on behalf of George Washington and all of his family descendants who are now spread across this great nation, I want to express our gratitude for your patience in waiting so long for the return of this important book and for your generosity in erasing the considerable fines that were probably owed by George Washington to this august institution. We're also grateful that you did this for all of the right reasons. There was no sort of political pressure at all from the Federalist Party, I promise you. Still, we can't help feeling guilty that the president, who usually set a near-perfect example for all Americans to follow, did something totally out of character. He did not do his public duty. From all we can tell, he took out these two books, took them out of circulation, and perhaps did that forever. Fortunately, over the past year, we've been focused almost totally on George Washington and books. Where he got them, which ones he owned, what he borrowed, and what has happened to many of these books since his death. And Joan Stahl has been responsible for all of this. Lo and behold, a couple of weeks ago, she came across one of the two titles that Washington borrowed and never returned. Joan first gave Mark a call to determine if the book was not, if not the exact same book that Washington borrowed, it was at least what you might call a dead ringer. So she bargained a great price, and we bought it, and now we brought it up to return to your collection. Although the leather spine is a later replacement, both the front and the back panels are original, and all the pages inside look to be in good condition. Interestingly, the title page is actually missing its top right-hand corner. If you want to come up and look later, it actually is missing this corner right up here. And that's exactly the location that George Washington used to write his name in all of his library books. So there are all sorts of scenarios one can imagine, including the possibility that Washington somehow forgot the book was borrowed rather than bought or received as a gift. So maybe he mistakenly signed the title page as he usually did, and then later, some kind of collector who didn't really know what they were doing decided that he would clip off the Washington signature, which was even very valuable in the 19th century. And that's just one of the many possibilities, the stories that can be told about this volume. It is our pleasure to bring it back, and I'd like to ask now if Joan could join me up here. And we're going to make the official presentation to return this book back to where it belongs. On behalf of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which dates back all the way to 1853, celebrating our 150th anniversary, we now return this book to you for safekeeping forever and ever in your library. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you very much, Jim. On behalf of the New York Society Library, we are very pleased to accept this generous gift, which rekindles our ties with the man who was and is first in the hearts of his countrymen. We are proud of our ties with George Washington and his ties to our great city. He was with us in New York in good times and bad. His courage and resourcefulness helped avoid what came very close to defeat by the British in the Revolutionary War on this very island in September of 1776. And his inauguration here in 1789 served to focus all the positive energy of the young nation. This book will be cherished as part of the New York Society Library's special connection with this great man. And by the authority invested in me by no one in particular, I hereby absolve George Washington and his representatives from any and all overdue library fines. And I am pleased to extend the privileges of membership in our library to the Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like now to introduce our head librarian, Mark Bartlett, for a few comments, and then Jim will speak further about their library project.
Emmerich de Vattel was a noted Swiss jurist who was born in 1714 and died in 1767. Les Droits des gens, or the Law of Nations, is considered one of the great treatises on international law. It was first published in Neuchâtel in 1758. And the Society Library is quite confident that the edition we are being presented today is similar to the copy that we owned back then. This book was especially influential with the founding fathers of the United States, many of whom were fluent in French. Jefferson had a copy of the 1775 French edition and reportedly used it when he was writing the Declaration of Independence. The term natural-born citizen that we've been hearing a lot in the last couple of years is often credited to Vattel, whose definition was those born in the country of parents who are citizens. We are so pleased to have this edition of the Law of Nations back in the library, and something tells me that we're probably going to have a few visitor and reader requests to look at this book in the near future. Thank you, Mount Vernon. Thank you, Jim and Joan. The Society Library's investigation of the President Washington story, the very interesting President Washington story, was spurred by a recent project that we've been doing to conserve, house, digitize, and equally as important, analyze the first charging ledger from our library's archives. As the press release in your packet explains further, the first charging ledger of 1789 to 92 is a window to the borrowing and reading history of early New Yorkers. Examining the ledger over the last year, we learned that Aaron Burr was a very big reader, making his way through Gibbon, Swift, and Voltaire. George Clinton was a serious reader, too, with not one novel on his list of Hobbes, Tasso, Herodotus, and Polybius. About John Jay, library trustee and former chair William J. Dean remarked in his article, Book Selections of the Founding Fathers, published in the New York Law Journal, Chief Justice Jay must have had his own collection of law books, for few of the books borrowed by him from the New York Society are law-related. What stands out when examining the library's charging ledger is both the breadth of his interests and his wide reading in literature, history, travel, and science. Mount Vernon also plays an important role in studying early America, and in particular, the life, work, and legacy of our first president. Jim Rees will explain further the great work that's happening at Mount Rees.
We really wouldn't be standing here today because we wouldn't have found this book if books had not been the thing we've been concentrating on the most for the past year. And that's for a very good and simple reason. It's because we hope to break ground as early as the next George Washington's birthday on the equivalent of a presidential library for George Washington. We've kind of gotten irked that all these modern presidents get to build these humongous libraries in their own honor, and yet there's still no library that celebrates the life and character of our first president, who many people think is still our best president. And to many modern Americans, we can honestly say, and we can prove with focus groups and surveys and other statistics, that they're losing touch with George Washington. Most scholars still rank him first, but men on the street polls rank him seventh or eighth, often behind people like Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, among others. Some history textbooks have just one-tenth the coverage that history textbooks had 50 years ago on George Washington. And we no longer celebrate George Washington's birthday. And his portrait has disappeared from the classroom. And the Mint has tried on two occasions to eliminate the best PR thing we have going for us, which is that great dollar bill image. As a result, the one historic figure the entire nation used to actually embrace and celebrate is losing touch with the American people. As David McCullough has noted on many occasions, we're raising a generation of historically illiterate children. What we hope is the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington that we hope to build will be the international headquarters for everything George Washington, which is a huge responsibility. The return of this book, in a small way, is saying that George Washington did indeed love books much more than he loved bullets. And because we all know the name of Washington was synonymous with honesty, we're sure in the case of this book, the president simply lost track of time, or the book he checked out got shuffled between somewhere around 40,000 letters that we know George Washington hand wrote during his life. So I want to pause for just a second and show you just really in a minute, just a couple of minutes, a few of the almost 500 acres of land. And so we're going to put our library right here, which is quite a ways from the mansion and all the historic buildings, which are centered here. And the Potomac River is here, and Maryland is over there. And we selected this site after doing thorough archaeology and discovering there were no 18th century buildings located in that site. The library is mostly one story, a small portion is two story, and also has a basement that's tucked underground. In this library, there'll be three distinct parts. One will be built for scholars who want to do serious research and live up to a year at Mount Vernon to conduct that research. We're doing everything we can to make sure there are more dissertations on George Washington, more books written on George Washington, and he gets back into the forefront of scholarship in the coming years. The second part is that we have a group of people in this building who are educators who are going to use every way they possibly can to take this new information and spread it out to the general public. That means we're getting more involved in television and movies and the internet, of course. We're spending $2 million over a period of 18 months to totally renovate our website. And finally, in this wing, we have a brand new seminar center because we're going to attract leadership groups when they come to Washington out to Mount Vernon for anywhere from a half-day to two-day-long sessions on George Washington's leadership and character and how it relates to leaders of today. We've already done experiments with the FBI and the CIA, and they say it's great, and we know it's working. The library will be, this is an artist's rendition of the back of the library, and probably the central focus will be the two-story glass reading room. And inside, it will look in a different way, rich, we hope, just like the room we're sitting in today, but also open to the environment that's George Washington's just outside. You'll be able to walk from this building not only to the historic area and all of our historic buildings, but also to our restaurants, our auditoriums, and all the spaces that we don't have to duplicate in this library. For that reason, we keep it down to 45,000 square feet, which is much, much, much less of a building than they built for Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and the others. And then finally, this is one of those seminar rooms we talked about. We hope to get corporate boards and nonprofit boards and government groups to send their leaders to Mount Vernon so that we can help to teach them about the greatest leader we think the nation has ever known. And we're real excited about this. We've already raised $38 million toward this goal of at least $80 million. And so we hope to break ground in February and open this new library by George Washington's birthday in 2013. So I'll be happy to answer questions afterwards. Joan is standing next to two of the books that will go in this library. We own about 40 Washington titles. And there are prized possessions, and the rare books room in this building, we hope, will come to scholars and to people like you, who include scholars, somewhat like the cupola, a trip to the cupola is to the mansion at Mount Vernon. It'll be just that important and inspirational of an experience. So again, Charles, thank you for hosting us today, and it's a pleasure to add something to your library.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you very much. I'd just like to note that our original charging ledger, which will be digitized and available, I think, this fall to the public in general, is on display over here for any who would like to look at it, and the famous entries of October 5, 1789. And we would be delighted to have questions if you have questions for Jim or Joan or Mark or myself. Yes, Benita. The question was how many books George Washington actually owned in his collection. Maybe, Joan, you could answer that.
Much like this book is a duplicate, the same edition as the one that George Washington mistakenly put aside. And we've already achieved that.
I presume you will also have in your library scholarly works about Washington that have been written over the years. Do you have a sense of what the volume of that material is? And you mentioned, Jim, that there were as many as 40,000 letters written by George Washington, which is quite astonishing. Is there any primary repository of those letters? I imagine they're collected everywhere, but
they are spread out quite widely, and they come up every year for auction. So it's not a year that I can remember we haven't bought several Washington letters. But the important thing that Joan referred to is that editors at the University of Virginia have been compiling all those letters into volumes, and they've already printed about 60 volumes. They expect to print at least 30 more volumes, and by the time it's finished, there'll be 90-some volumes of letters written by George Washington. And all of those records come to Mount Vernon at the end of the project. Most modern presidential libraries are actually kind of archival holding places for a president's written works. Mm-hmm. We think that that's, for us, the next best thing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Great. Yes?
Is there any sort of precedent for this in terms of a historical figure's book being returned back to a library? I'm just curious if this is sort of the first time.
I'm not aware of it, but maybe Mark could enlighten us.
Well, based on the response to the original article that was published by the Daily News, we read a lot of the online response from other news media, from blogs, from individuals who wrote me to my private work email, phone calls. And I've not really heard of any other story that used a dollar figure that was out there that was this large. But someone said to me also that when people think of libraries, they think of overdue books. Everybody's had an overdue book and an overdue fine. So this being, you know, one of the oldest stories, it's certainly stayed out there in the media, and it's still kind of questions are still coming in about it.
We've never done it before. We could do the book easier. The fine was impossible. So.
I just wanted
to ask, do you read novels and poetry, and if so, who are the favorite? Well, there are poems. In fact, I brought along, Jim and I brought along with us one of the poetry books, poems in Scottish dialect by Robert Burns that Washington had. There are probably about 20 volumes of literature, and including poetry, that Washington had. So come.
Yes.
I was wondering if you have other people with overdue books and now people
with other people with overdue books and
who hold the title. Presumably he had the book that was out of the library for the longest.
Certainly by our records, I think that he did set the record, and I'm not sure that we keep very careful records of overdue books that are overdue for more than a couple of years, but it is a very happy resolution for us. Great. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Good. Well, we better keep this safe here.